Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening and blessings, and welcome to another installment of the Just for Freedom Estate. This show is produced by acclaimed historian, educator, and author Leslie Gist, and serves as our weekly live online discussion to celebrate the African-American experience by honoring all the people, past and present, black and white, who, with faith and focus, are preserving our rich history through literature, the arts, the skilled trades, and the humanities. We thank you for joining us tonight, and we'd love you to be a part of tonight's discussion by calling in with your comments or questions to 347-324-5552.
Good evening, and welcome to tonight's program. My name is Preston Washington. I'm your host. I'm located in Kansas City, Missouri. I'm the president of the Midwest Afro-American Genealogical Interest Coalition here in town. This program is brought to you by Leslie Gist, who is an author and historian, and we're coming to you over blogtalkradio.com/the Gist of Freedom. That's G-I-S-T. We have a very interesting guest tonight, Congressman Thaddeus Stevens, longtime lawyer in Pennsylvania. He was originally from the state of Vermont. He was also a state representative, eventually became a leading member of Congress during and after the Civil War. Congressman Stevens was a longtime abolitionist, played a key role in writing and passing the 13th Amendment to end slavery as a matter of law, and also the 14th Amendment to promise equality before the law. Are you there, Congressman?
Indeed I am, sir.
Thank you for joining us tonight. Could you start out by telling our audience something about your youth and your origins?
Oh, certainly, sir. And I thank you for having me.
Certainly, sir. Certainly. Well, I grew up, as I say, in Vermont. My father left when I was 12 years old. My mother moved the family so I could have an education. I attended the Peacham Academy and then Dartmouth and then the the University of Vermont, what was at the time, Burlington College, and followed some of my classmates to Pennsylvania, where I would live for the rest of my life, was a school teacher in York, and been a lawyer in Gettysburg for 25 years, and 25 more in Lancaster.
Now, you were telling us about your involvement with the abolitionist movement, or the Underground Railroad. Were you in contact, who were some of the notable folk abolitionists that you came to know during that period?
Later on in my life, as I became a more prominent politician, I had the good fortune to meet some of the great lights of my day. That Frederick Douglass hung a portrait of me, not a very attractive face, I'm sure, but hung a portrait of me in his home. And I returned the compliment in Congress once. Scoundrel across the aisle was making some not so complimentary comments about the intellect of the average African American man, and I stood up in Congress and I told him that I would be more than happy to arrange a battle of wits between himself and Frederick Douglass anywhere, anytime. And he stared at me for a moment and he quietly sat back down. So, but yes, I did have some contact in the Underground Railroad, and in the abolitionist movement, there were bounty hunters and kidnappers who really didn't care if they had the right man or not in Gettysburg, and especially later on in Lancaster. Some of them kept spies among the abolitionist community to know where and when to hunt for their quarry, and I'm proud to say that I had a spy or two among their spies. Keep an eye on where they would be hunting.
Okay, and before we get to your involvement with the 13th and 14th Amendment, I understand that you were instrumental.
Oh, yes, sir. I always said, even in the last years of my life, after I had helped to change the United States Constitution, I always said that the most important thing I ever did was helping to bring public education to Pennsylvania. I was a first-term state representative in 1834 when we passed the school law, which said that every township and borough in Pennsylvania would become a school district The voters in each district would vote each year whether to begin creating free public schools with some financial help from the state, or continue without those schools and without the financial aid. We created in the stroke of a pen at 987 school districts in Pennsylvania. Half of them decided to give public schools a chance, half of them did not, and there was a backlash. I'm sure in your time it would be hard to imagine such a thing, but there were those who said that public education was too expensive, school teachers too highly paid, school taxes too high. I elected a whole new slate of state legislators, state representatives, state senators, with a mission to repeal this school law to end public education in Pennsylvania. They very nearly succeeded the following year, in 1835. As I say, I was in my first term. I had no real power. But education had changed my life, had taken me from my poor farm in Vermont and made me a leader in my community, a state representative, a successful lawyer. So I stood up to speak, spoke for 2 hours that day. But even those across the aisle from me, even my rivals at the time, said they had never heard such passion, such eloquence in those halls there in Harrisburg. As I spoke, some of the state senators who had already voted to repeal the school law drifted into the gallery to listen. When I was done, the state house voted to keep the school law after all, and the state senate went back and voted again and decided this time to keep the law. So public education would continue in Pennsylvania. Later in my life, as a member of the United States Congress, I was proud to be instrumental in bringing public education to the city of Washington, D.C. as well.
Okay, and moving back to Pennsylvania here, I understand that black men during your period had the right to vote, but they lost that right to vote in the state of Pennsylvania. Could you go into that?
Yes, indeed, sir. Yes, indeed. I was telling you about my role in bringing public education to Pennsylvania. I am very proud of that work. The members of my party were not so pleased with my work. I lost my seat that fall, which meant I was available 2 years later, 1837, to be a delegate to a constitutional convention in Harrisburg to create a new state constitution. And I was looking forward to it. The existing constitution was unclear on a few things, including voting rights. It said in order to vote in Pennsylvania, you had to be a freeman. F-R-E-E-M-A-N. It did not define the term. So who was a freeman? Was a free black man a freeman? Could he vote? The state constitution was not clear. The state Supreme Court refused to rule. So it was left to the district courts, where some judges said yes and some said no. So in some parts of Pennsylvania, black men, free black men, could vote for 50 years. In others, they could not. And then you have the constitutional convention, and I went with high hopes of guaranteeing the right of every free man, black or white, across the state to cast his ballot. And I failed. I failed. One of the delegates from the other end of the political spectrum proposed a different solution, which ultimately had the votes to succeed. My fellow delegates added a single word to the state constitution, said that in order to vote in Pennsylvania, you must be a white freeman. I already knew how difficult it was to guarantee the rights of those who are being trampled upon. I learned that day exactly how fragile those rights can be, that they can be yours for 50 years and snatched away with a stroke of a pen.
When were when did the law allow landless whites to vote?
I do not have the date on the tip of my tongue at the moment. It was always a contentious issue back and forth whether all free people could vote, whether those who owned land only. I could not off the top of my head give you the precise date when we changed that here in Pennsylvania.
Okay. Now, and what was your exact role in the 13th Amendment?
I am asked sometimes a preliminary question here, because once people learn that I pushed President Lincoln to issue the Emancipation Proclamation, they ask me why we needed a 13th Amendment. If he had already issued the proclamation that said that those being held in slavery in Confederate territory were now free, why did we need a 13th Amendment? Well, the simple answer is that President Lincoln issued the proclamation under his war powers. Once the war was over, the proclamation might, in the eyes of the courts, expire. So I believe that we must write and pass and ratify a 13th Amendment to guarantee that slavery would never come back. I honestly believed that if we did not do away with slavery once and for all, years and money and lives that had gone to the Civil War might be for nothing. We might end up having to fight the war all over again. So I am proud to say that I wrote the first draft of the 13th Amendment. I helped to push it through to passage in Congress.
Okay. And what are your thoughts on the way that Steven Spielberg displayed you or portrayed you in this movie, Lincoln?
I have heard some stories and noticed some new questions since people in your day have begun seeing this. I am delighted to know that suddenly people know my name. They are somewhat familiar with some of my work with the 13th Amendment, that they are perhaps. There has been so much disinformation about my life spread over the years. I'm glad to have a depiction of me that seems, from what I gather, to be reasonably positive. I always tell people, it's one thing when you realize that one of your biographers has as a key thesis in their book-length biography of your life, that everything you ever did was driven by the fact that you were a self-hating cripple. There's another thing entirely to realize that this is the first biography in 50 years that is hailed as the one that is being kind to you. I'll give you an idea of how historians have treated my life. So I'm delighted to know that there is finally a work out there telling my story from a little bit closer to my own point of view.
Who was Charles Sumner? Was you present in the chamber when he was attacked?
Well, I was not present when he was attacked. He was in the Senate, I was in the House. But we both had the experience of saying the wrong thing to some of our fellow representatives on the other side of the aisle. In my case, it came in 1859, 3 days after John Brown was executed for his assault on the federal arsenal at Harper's Ferry. I returned to the Congress for the first time in 6 years. My second day back, one of my opponents from the other side of the aisle came at me on the floor of the United States Congress with a Bowie knife, a blade a foot long. I forgot they said the only senators or congressmen who went to the Capitol and did not have a pistol in their pocket were those who had two. I guess my friend Mr. Sumner over in the Senate a few years earlier had said something rather indelicate about the South and about slavery, and one of his colleagues over there in the Senate came back to him later that day when he was working at his desk and beat him with a walking stick until it broke. He was left quite crippled for quite a while after that.
Okay, I want to back up here a minute. There was a famous, a very important court case called the Christina Resistance. Were you involved in that?
Oh, yes.
Was that a federal or a state case?
Well, let me start at the beginning. In 1851, September 11th, 1851, of all things, in 1851, a Maryland farmer, Edward Gorsuch, came up into Pennsylvania chasing four men who had escaped from him. He gathered a posse and a United States Marshal, and he went to a tiny little community called Christiana in Lancaster County, Pennsylvania, to the home of a free black man, William Parker. They burst into Mr. Parker's house. Mr. Gorsuch demanded the return of his property. Words were exchanged, shots were fired, and when it was all over, Mr. Gorsuch was dead, his son badly wounded. 24 black men were arrested and charged with treason, along with 3 white Quakers who had done nothing more than pass by and refuse to get involved, all charged with a federal crime of treason. I dropped what I was doing. I went out to Christiana as quickly as I could. I served on the defense team. And ultimately, it took a little bit of doing. not entirely the most honest and upright and straightforward of my court cases, but in the end, we ensured that no one was convicted of any federal crime. There were two of them who were charged with lesser state offenses, but no one was convicted of treason. No one convicted of any federal crime, and in fact, the judge instructed the jury that although he personally considered abolitionists like myself to be nothing more than troublemakers, what the Quakers in particular had done, passing by, refusing to get involved, certainly did not rise to the level of a crime, which is interesting because a year earlier we had passed the Fugitive Slave Act in Congress, which said that very specifically that if bounty hunters or a posse like Mr. Gorsuch's came into a free state and demanded that a free citizen help them to capture a fugitive, that you must cooperate or you're in violation of federal crime. So our judge told the jury that what was now a brand new federal crime was in fact, in his eyes, no crime at all. The Fugitive Slave Act became a dead letter in Pennsylvania. An interesting side note, by the way, Mr. Gorsuch had a son at home who heard that his father was dead and his brother badly wounded and no one was being held responsible in terms of any federal crime. He went to a friend of his from school, and the two of them swore together somewhere, somehow, someday they would get their revenge. His friend is someone I'm sure you've heard of, John Wilkes Booth. In 1851, 14 years before Ford's Theater, swearing to get revenge for this, in his eyes, miscarriage of justice.
Okay, you had mentioned your work as an abolitionist. There was you and there was some. Who was Ashley?
The particular name you're asking about is not immediately ringing a bell, but there were so many men I worked with. I'm sure it will come back to me eventually, but telling you about my regret when I realized that having taken that case all the way to the state Supreme Court, having won, that it was my victory in court that caused that young woman and her children to be taken back into slavery for the rest of their lives. I made up my mind I would never, ever do that again. I never did. I never did take that side on a case like that ever again. Instead, whenever fugitives would come to Pennsylvania and come to Adams County and need help in the court, I always took their case, whether they could pay me a dime or not. My neighbor said years later, looking back, they could not remember me ever having lost one of those cases. I always seemed to find some way to help.
So your involvement there, taking up these cases, did that lead into your involvement in the Underground Railroad?
Well, as a good politician, I can neither confirm nor deny my involvement in an illegal venture, but I certainly was willing to help fugitives in the court, work to change the law as well. And there are those who will tell you that I worked outside of the law as well, that I helped fugitives there in Gettysburg and later in Lancaster. There was a great deal of interest just a few years ago. They found a cistern, a water tank, except it had no sign of ever having had water in it. Instead, they found at one end a small doorway and a tunnel that led to a secret panel in the tavern next door, which I had also owned, and an air shaft leading up to the surface that some people will tell you was used as a hiding place for fugitives. Again, as a good politician, I cannot publicly confirm my involvement in any such enterprise, but whoever might have been involved in such a thing certainly was on the moral high ground, as it were. The heart was in the right place.
Okay. Would you, before I present the next question, could you repeat your website again?
Sure. GreatTalesLive.com.
That was prior to the emancipation.
I'm sorry, I didn't catch the last part of the question.
The Confiscation Act was prior to the emancipation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I'm sure Thaddeus was kind of two minds about it. There were some cases early on in the Civil War, and Congressman Stevens is on record being appalled by these, where men or women or children being held in slavery would escape, make their way to the front lines, appeal to the Union troops for help, and the Union commanders would take them back. Stevens is on record in Congress fuming about this. He said it was as if our troops were heading into the South with a rifle in one hand and shackles in the other, when we should be heading into the battlefield with a rifle in one hand and the Book of Freedom, he said, in the other. The Confiscation Act and the whole concept of contraband basically said that the laws of war say that if you're fighting with somebody and you happen to capture a piece of their property, you have every right to hold on to it. And therefore, if you happen to catch a piece of what they consider property, i.e. enslaved people, you can hold on to them too, and you don't have to turn them over, which on the one hand means we're no longer taking escaped enslaved people back to their masters. On the other hand, it also means that the Union Army and the federal government is recognizing these people as property that can therefore be contraband. I'm positive that Thaddeus was horrified by that part of it, but if that was what gave the government the authority to help people to escape,
did you deal with the devil? If so, what is your general perspective on the movie?
Well, let me put it this way. I would have been more pleased with it if there was some indication in the movie that it was possible for a black citizen to be something other than a servant or a spectator.
What was Thaddeus' relationship with the black community? Or did he live in a black community?
He lived in a series of different places, most of which had some black residents. The story that really sticks with me is that he left instructions when he died that he was to be buried in the one integrated cemetery in Lancaster. It's off by itself, some distance from the bigger, nicer cemeteries. And he wrote his own epitaph that says that he didn't choose to lie there because he disliked humanity, but because it was the one cemetery in town that was not segregated by race, that he wanted to make sure that he died as he lived, committed to the idea of.
What was the name of that cemetery again?
Shriner.
Pastor.
It's not named for the Shriners. It was named for a man named Shriner, but that is the name of it, Shriner, in Lancaster. I like to tell people sometimes that Thaddeus Stevens and James Buchanan, the president before Lincoln, are both buried in Lancaster, as far apart from each other as they can possibly be, while both being buried in Lancaster.
Okay, the movie also depicted that he might have had a love interest with an African-American.
We know some things. We know that he had a woman who worked for him, Lydia Hamilton Smith, who worked for him for, I think, 25 years. The history books tend to use the 19th century term that she was his housekeeper. I kind of shy away from that term just because it has a completely different meaning today. In the 19th century, a housekeeper was not a maid, was not somebody who cleaned up. The housekeeper was the person who kept the house, the chief of staff, the manager of the estate, so a much more, very different kind of position than the way that we would use the term. We know that they were friends. We know that they were confidants. We know that he helped her to raise her two sons. We know that she helped him to raise his two nephews after his brother died. There's speculation, and has been speculation for a long time, that their relationship went beyond friendship. I haven't really ever seen any direct evidence to support that. Ultimately, the historians who go with that view end up footnoting somebody who footnotes somebody who footnotes somebody, and ultimately the story ends up going back to two editorials
neither of which was really trying to paint an objective view. Basically, editorials from during and immediately after the Civil War that were throwing all kinds of accusations at Thaddeus Stevens, and at that time suggesting that you know, that he didn't really believe the stuff that he was saying. It was just, you know, because he had this illicit love affair. You know, it's quite possible. There are people who staunchly believe it. I can't say that it didn't happen. All I can say is the only evidence that I've seen is from sources that I wouldn't really trust to tell me anything else accurate about Thaddeus Stevens either.
What was your reaction to the movie, the way it ended with Thaddeus in bed with that woman? And were you surprised?
I mean, there, as I say, there are people who swear that this was a romantic relationship. There are people who say, no, it wasn't. I just don't know for sure. The one thing that did trouble me kind of goes back to what I was saying about the relative lack of African-American characters in the movie who actually have some agency. The idea that freedom, the 13th Amendment, the end of slavery, was something that white people did for black people is incredibly inaccurate, and really did kind of bug me. I'm sure that's not really the message they were trying to send, but that's what I heard in that particular moment.
Now, I picked up her middle and last name, Hamilton Smith. What was her first name?
Lydia. Her family was also... we know that they were involved with the Underground Railroad. One of my favorite stories, her sons worked with a local volunteer fire department in Lancaster. And there is a story, I don't know exactly how much evidence there is to back it up, but there is a story that says that they would sometimes make a big deal of going to respond to a fire over on one side of town, you know, all the bells clanging and everything, and everybody would go and rush to look while they quietly had some fugitives coming in from the other side of the town. So everybody's out looking for looking at the fire, and nobody's seeing the fugitives coming and going. We also know that Lydia Hamilton Smith learned from Thaddeus Stevens. He had for years been using the money from his law practice to buy real estate. He taught her about real estate, and after his death, she goes on to amass a pretty sizable fortune at a time when in some parts of the country, even white women usually might not be encouraged to own property. So she does pretty well for herself after he's gone.
Now, was Lydia married? Did Thaddeus have a wife?
Thaddeus never married. Lydia Hamilton Smith was a widow. Her original husband had died.
Do we know much about him?
Okay.
I really want to thank you, Steve Anderson, and Thaddeus, for joining us this evening. We're going to have
thank you for having both of us.
And could you give us your contact information, how people can get a hold of you if they should want to ask you further questions or have comments?
Sure. The website is greattaleslive.com. And if you go there, there's also an email link down at the bottom.
Okay. Thank you. Very, very interesting. Very important information. Although the film may have had some shortcomings, the information on Thaddeus was very interesting, and we're so glad that you were able to join us. I want to remind our listeners that our next interview will be at 7:30 or 9:30 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. I understand we have a descendant of a slave who was freed or helped to freedom by Thaddeus Stevens. Well, just before we go off, we got a caller. Are you there, caller?
Yes, I am.
Tell us your name and where you're calling from.
My name is Jacob Morris. I'm the director of the Harlem Historical Society. Well, abolitionism is a specialty of mine. Thaddeus Stevens I always saw as a key. I got to hand it to you. You've really been asking some excellent questions. And just an aspect of the maneuvering in regards to the passage of the amendment. When he was young and he had just gotten elected to the Pennsylvania legislature, and this was in the early 1830s, there was no free public schools in Pennsylvania. For parents who wished to educate their children, but they couldn't, and so many couldn't pay or bear the cost, could have them admitted free only by making a declaration of pauperism, as few people at that time cared to declare themselves as paupers. Thousands and thousands and thousands of children received no schooling. So a bill was introduced early in his second term by a joint committee to extend the Philadelphia system to the entire state. Stevens was heartily in favor of the measure, and even his adversary, the governor, Governor Wolf, was in favor of it. However, after it passed, there was a taxpayer revolt, kind of almost like a Tea Party thing.
Okay. Yeah, Thaddeus covered that for us. Could either of you, Steve, are you still there?
Mm-hmm.
Do either of you, could you recommend any books, museums, or historical societies where our listeners might learn more about Thaddeus?
Well, two books, but two that I personally like are, there's an old one called Thaddeus Stevens, Being Darkly Wise and Rudely Great by Ralph Korngold. And there's a second book by a great woman biographer, Fawn Brody, Thaddeus Stevens, Scourge of the South. She was the lady in the 1970s who wrote the book on Jefferson that brought out in a scholarly manner the relationship that Jefferson had with Sally Hemings. That's an excellent, excellent biography of Stevens.
I'd actually recommend two others, both more recent, for a wonderfully accessible biography of Stevens, Hans Trefus. I don't remember the title off the top of my head, but my favorite for substance on Stevens is a man named Brad Hoch, H-O-C-H, about Thaddeus Stevens in Gettysburg. That goes far beyond his time in Gettysburg, but it is really looking at how he went from being, you know, just this young lawyer starting out to being somebody who had the passion and the commitment to become the major abolitionist that he ends up being.
Okay, and Steve, we really appreciate your joining us. Jacob, we appreciate your calling into the show. And I want our listeners to know that they're on www.blackhistoryblog.com. Thanks again, Steve, for joining us.
Can I share one last thing with you, Preston?
Yeah, go ahead.
One of these stories that I love and I have never had a chance to share in public, because it's so far out of the time period that I'm in when I'm performing at Thaddeus. But after the 13th Amendment, he's instrumental in writing and passing the 14th Amendment, equality under the law. Almost 100 years later, the court case that everybody's heard about, Brown v. Board of Education, to try and desegregate public schools. Thurgood Marshall goes to the Supreme Court. He's arguing that, you know, under the 14th Amendment, everybody should have the right to go to the best schools in town, regardless of race. The Supreme Court is mostly convinced, but not entirely. And the key thing that's sticking in their craw is the argument by the opposing counsel that this was not the original intent of the 14th Amendment. We still argue today about, you know, original intent of, you know, parts of the Constitution. And how do you prove what was and was not the original intent? And so finally the Supreme Court decides we're going to hear arguments again in 6 months, specifically on these sticking points, including original intent. So Thurgood Marshall and his legal team, they're putting together a new brief over the next few months, doing all kinds of research. They've found ways to address all of the points against desegregation except original intent. How do you prove it? And then just a few days, like I think it's 3 days, before they're going to have to present their brief to the Supreme Court for the second time, one of his law assistants stumbled over a quote from Thaddeus Stevens from the debate when they were passing the 14th Amendment, saying that in his view, the government should recognize no distinctions except for merit. Shouldn't make decisions based on, you know, what you look like or where you're from, just based on, you know, who's qualified, who's best for the position, you know, et cetera.
Mm-hmm.
And so they put that quote on the cover of the brief that they're sending to the Supreme Court. And that's the time the Supreme Court decides to agree with them, and Brown v. Board of Education becomes, you know, a landmark case toward desegregating public schools across America. And I love the fact that Thaddeus Stevens is there on the cover.
And Thaddeus Stevens was right there with it. Wow.
Mm-hmm.
Again, Steve, we appreciate your joining us tonight. Maybe we can get together and talk more about this subject at a future date.
Thank you for having me.
Okay. Good night.
Good night.